the Mental Capacity Act and Living Wills. We hope that the guide is self-explanatory. We've tried to make it as accessible as possible. The Mental Capacity Act is about people who are not able to make decisions for themselves, but not about children or people who are mentally ill. Well, it could be about people who are mentally ill, but not because they can't make a decision because they're mentally ill. If you just happen to be mentally ill, but your decision-making capacity is due to becoming unconscious from a road accident or something, and it can happen to anyone, then it applies to you just as it applies to anybody else. But things which are specifically about mental ill health come under its own regulations, under the Mental Health Act. So this is specifically about other forms of incapacity. And it doesn't relate to children, because again, they have their own legislation for children specifically. It's about all kinds of decision making, for example, financial decision making. So it's not just about healthcare, but nevertheless, it does include healthcare. And I think it's the healthcare decisions, most of which is the newer stuff in the Act, which has caused some anxiety. Again, with regard to healthcare, it's not just about the question of withdrawing treatment or withholding treatment, but it does importantly involve this issue. So it's about more than healthcare, it's about financial decisions and so on too, and healthcare is about more than just withdrawing treatment, but withdrawing treatment is significant, so that's what I'm going to focus on, and that's a lot of what our guide focuses on. So again, the guide isn't a comprehensive guide to all aspects of the Mental Capacity Act, but it focuses on healthcare issues, and particularly those that have caused anxiety around withholding and withdrawing. The first thing to say is that withholding or withdrawing treatment, medical treatment, is sometimes legitimate. And this makes it different from acts like suicide or euthanasia, which, at least according to the Catholic tradition, are always wrong. It's controversial among some people that they should always seem to be wrong, but at least from a traditional moral point of view, the answer with regard to suicide and euthanasia is quite simple. The answer is no. Whereas it's not quite so simple with withholding and withdrawing. It depends on the circumstances. Might be right or might not be right. It depends on the intention. Depends what you're trying to intend. This makes it difficult to lay down rules. I mean, you can lay down quite easy rules, let's say, with respect to, say, suicide, euthanasia. It's more difficult to lay down rules with respect to withholding and withdrawing, because it is sometimes a sensible thing to do and sometimes not. So is there anything we can say? There are various things. I mean, that's what we try to do in the guide, really, is to paint a little bit of a map, not to say that you can lay down rules, but to give people a sense of what are the sorts of things at stake here. And something which occurred to me while the whole process, it took a long process, this booklet, and as Archbishop Peter said, lots of consultation throughout the whole genesis of it, and also, I mean, I think our own ideas, certainly my ideas, shifted while I was writing it. And one of the things which came very clear to me is that there are at least two, but I'll focus on two, there are at least two important goods which are at stake when you think about withdrawing or withholding treatment. There's the good of living well, and there's the good of dying well, if I can put it like that. Or I could put it, there's the good of cherishing life, and there's the good of accepting death. So with cherishing life and living well comes the good, the importance of giving needed treatment. If somebody needs treatment, partly how you show your concern for their life is by giving them the treatment they need. And part of dying well and part of accepting death is avoiding futile or burdensome treatment. Now, avoiding futile and burdensome treatment is not only to do with accepting death. I mean, there's all sorts of burdensome treatment which is good to avoid, which has nothing to do with death. I mean, I think of my mother had a couple of operations on her sinuses, after each one of which she was worse off than the time before. And I think it was on the third offer of a further operation that she decided that the time was to draw a line. and that she did not want further treatment, which where the last treatment hadn't been beneficial, then she would prefer to live with the problem that she has than risk it getting any worse. So there are all sorts of reasons for any medical treatments that you might think, is it worth it? Is it going to work? What are the risks? Is it going to be more not worthwhile? But those sort of issues become more pressing when you're approaching death, because the likelihood of benefit gets reduced, and whereas the burdens are often not reduced. So often you still have the same burdens, but the chance of benefit. So the avoiding futile treatment becomes more pressing in particular in relation to accepting death. So this giving treatment when it's needed and not giving treatment when it's not needed relates to, as it were, opposite dangers: the danger of under-treating, not treating when you should, and the danger of over-treating, of treating when you shouldn't. Now, when we were writing this document, various people, because we used the phrases over-treatment and under-treatment, and some people said, oh, it's not traditional Catholic language, you should use futile and burdensome or something, but not these. And some people said, oh, I'm not sure that doctors would understand this, I'm not sure it's typical. But I was very happy that I'm on a working group to look at the GMC guidance on withholding and withdrawing, and they start with over-treatment and under-treatment as categories. So these are medical categories, but I think that's quite sensible categories. It really struck me that the one insight I suppose I had personally when in writing this, which really came home to me, was I went to a conference in Cambridge. It was organised by the Christian Medical Fellowship, and nearly everybody there was doctors, and it was about withdrawal and treatment generally. And it really struck me at this meeting that about half of the group there were really concerned about under-treatment. They were really concerned about neglect, a neglect of older people, neglect of disabled people. They were really worried about withdrawal of food and fluids in particular, but treatment in general. That there were some people who were not high on the social pecking order, who people would make adverse judgments about their life not being worthwhile, who wouldn't get the treatment they needed. And there was another set of people who were really anxious about over-treatment, about people being badgered into the grave, about people having unnecessary treatment, particularly at the end of life, of having witnessed, I mean, I've seen it myself, I'm sure a lot of people have, people close to them, who when they were dying, they were not allowed to die in peace, but they had unnecessary, burdensome treatment, which made their death much worse than they otherwise would have been. And it also struck me that these groups were, I mean, you could just almost divide, they weren't all sort of sitting in the same place, but that you could almost divide the audience into one of these camps, and nearly everybody there was either obviously a much more concerned about one, or obviously a much more concerned about the other. And they tended also to slightly belittle the opposite problem, because they said, oh no, under-treatment, yeah, it does happen, but that's not real. The problem is over-treatment. I can tell you, I've seen it, that's the problem, and the other isn't. Or they say, no, the problem is people being neglected, that's the problem, and the other isn't. And it really struck me that partly they were talking across each other, and also that both of their concerns were legitimate concerns. Both are legitimate concerns. And it's not just that there's a sort of compromise, as it were, between over-treating a bit and under-treating a bit, but that both of these goods, the good of cherishing life and the good of accepting that we will die and acting appropriately, that both of these are goods which we need to grasp hold of simultaneously. And at that time I was, I'd just been rereading a bit of G.K. Chesterton, who said, Christianity reconciles furious opposites by keeping both and keeping both furious. So there's this notion of there are furious opposites, or seemingly furious opposites, fully God, fully human. And rather than saying, oh, well, a little bit of one, it keeps both and keeps both furious. And that's what we need to do in this context. We need to keep both and keep both furious. Both furiously be attached to cherishing life, and furiously attached to accepting that this life is a mortal life and has an end. Both that while life goes on, we never neglect out of a lack of love of life, but also that we don't, as it were, hang on to life a grim death because we fail to acknowledge that death will come, and that we need to be able to die well. And in fact, dying well is part of living well. So that was my, as it were, one insight. And it informs in partly how the guide is set up, and it also, I think, helps to create a balance, because another thing that struck me in this group was, even though most people still, even having said this, most people still, they are more concerned about one individually. I think that's probably for most of us. They are more concerned about one or the other. It's important, even if they're to convince other people about that one, that they acknowledge the opposite one, because otherwise people won't hear. They won't hear that. So it's important, actually, even if you are more concerned about one or the other, that you mention both. So how does the Mental Capacity Act deal with these two features, these accepting death and cherishing life? Well, there are five key principles in the Act, which we quote in our guidance, but these can be boiled down even further to two. And they're basically, first of all, that you should presume capacity and support capacity. So the first thing is, you should never presume that because somebody seems a bit confused or other people in a similar situation don't have capacity, you should never assume that somebody is not able to make decisions. You should always assume they are able to make decisions, and if they have difficulty, you should support them in making their decisions. That's the first thing. And the second is, if there is no capacity, if you're sure that there's no capacity, for example, they're unconscious, no, clearly they're not making any decisions, if you're sure that there's no capacity, then you should act in their best interest. Whoever is acting for the person, whether it's a healthcare worker or whatever, they should act in the best interest of that person, and best interest includes more than physical health. Physical health is a part of our interests, it's a very important part of our interests, but it's not the only part of our interests. That we have other legitimate interests as well as health, which is included in, as it were, our total best interest. And I think both of those, properly understood, are principles that are acceptable from traditional Catholic understanding. We have free will. That's part of our dignity as human beings. That's part of our nature. We have to take responsibility for our own actions and support other people and respect other people in taking responsibility for theirs. G.K. Chesterton once said about democracy. He said democracy is a bit like tying your shoelaces. He said it's not that somebody else couldn't do it better for you, but it's part of growing up that you do it for yourself. And as in the political realm, so in an individual case, it's part of growing up that we do take responsibility for our actions. Not that other people might not make a better decision, but part of our taking responsibility for our life is that we make decisions for ourselves and that we respect other people's decisions. So with these principles, which I say I think are, and we say in the guide, are acceptable from a Catholic perspective if they're understood in a sensible way, that is a Catholic way, there come two key powers, and it's at this point when you move from principles to powers there's a question about how well these powers actually do serve these principles or interests. And the two, I mean, there are various new things in the Act, but the two key things which are new is the making, as part of statute law, of advanced decisions. Advanced decisions already were recognised in law because of case law and common law, but now advanced decisions have a statutory basis, including, and particularly, the advanced decision to refuse medical treatment, including an advanced decision to refuse treatment which might shorten your life, which might be life-sustaining treatment. So that's an important new aspect of the Act. And secondly, the ability to appoint someone to make decisions for you, a health and welfare attorney, which are a little bit like the old enduring powers of attorney for financial decisions. And indeed, the financial powers of attorney, they still exist in the new Act. So you can make you can appoint somebody as an attorney to make financial decisions for you, or you can appoint somebody as an attorney to make healthcare decisions for you, or somebody could fulfil both of those roles. So there's a new power, which is somebody making decisions for you for health and welfare decisions. I should just point out immediately that there is one important difference. There are several differences. One important difference between those two: a financial attorney gets their powers as soon as you appoint them. So that if you can't be bothered, as it were, making decisions for yourself, or you're just a bit confused and you just prefer to give somebody powers to look after some things for you, they can make decisions for you, including selling your house. So I mean, important to bear in mind this when making these. They are real powers that you give to other people, but they can make powers that you could to make a decision that you could have made, but you just find it convenient for them to make it. But with the health and welfare decisions, they can only make a decision if you're not able to. So health and welfare attorneys only gain their powers when you lose your power. And that's the difference between, it's one of the things which shows that the law is sensitive to a need to have more safeguards with respect to health and welfare than respect to money. I mean, it's bad enough somebody running off with your money, but life and health are more important than money. And so nobody makes a decision for you if you could make a decision for yourself. So from a Catholic perspective, I think these principles are acceptable, if understood sensibly. Advanced decisions can be legitimate, but can also cause problems. They could cause problems because, obviously, in life we sometimes make bad decisions, and if we make a decision in advance, that might be a bad decision, that might be an unwise decision. If we make a decision which affects our treatment, we may end up inadvertently harming ourselves, and other people might not be able to help us because of a decision which was made. And even if it's the case that there's a sort of legal way around it sometimes, I think the fact is, if something looks like an advanced decision, then clearly it's going to be taken very seriously, and probably the path of least resistance is that people are going to just take it on face value. So that even if it's not strictly applicable in the circumstances, or if it's not valid, it's likely to affect your treatment. And again, if you made it unwisely, it might have a bad effect. So advanced decisions are helpful if they allow you to make sensible decisions, but you might end up harming yourself inadvertently, and also preventing people who want to care for you from caring for you as best they would wish. However, sometimes you might pay perfectly good decisions, or even you might make unwise decisions, but it's for you to make them, not for somebody else, and you can't say that it's never right to make an advanced decision. Similarly with an attorney, you appoint an attorney, they make a decision for you. They may make a decision which you're very glad that they're in a position to make. They may make a bad decision. Most people think that they are good judges of character, but not everybody is a good judge of character. Most people realise that other people are not necessarily good judges of character, but they think of they themselves are. And so sometimes people who are appointed as attorneys are not the best person to be appointed, either because they're foolish, or sometimes even, regrettably, because they don't have the person's best interest at heart. This already happens sometimes with financial decisions. It could happen with healthcare decisions. So that's a danger. But on the other hand, an attorney may be able to give voice to what your concerns would have been, and that might be quite helpful. It's noticeable when we got all this stuff back from various people. The stuff we got from America, and this reflects other things I think I've seen in the past from America, is that people who are more cautious, more conservative in the American context tend to be quite strongly in favour of attorneys. And the reason is, they don't trust the doctors. Okay. They don't trust the doctors, so they want people to name attorneys, because they think at least you can trust the attorney, whereas you might not be able to trust the doctors. Whereas people who are, more cautious, more conservative in an English context, tend not to trust the relatives. So the problem is, if you're not around, somebody is going to be making the decision, and it's going to be more or less the doctor, or more or less the relative, or something in between. And there is no foolproof way in advance that you can specify which of these is a sensible thing to do. So in neither case does the guide recommend, and in neither case does the guide forbid the making of advanced decisions or the appointments of attorneys. These may be, for an individual in particular circumstances, perfectly reasonable things to do. But it would be rash in such a guide just to encourage people to do so without knowing the person they were thinking of to point as their attorney, or what sort of thing they were thinking of putting in an advanced decision. So we neither said you should never do it, nor did we recommend. Because these things, okay, they can be legitimate, but they can be cause problems. Hence the guide neither forbids nor recommends. I should say, in both cases, they're both cases where the Act gives powers, these extra powers, and then it tries to limit them in various ways. So there are safeguards in the Act. An advance decision has to be applicable to the circumstances. It has to be valid. It can be withdrawn at any time, verbally or even non-verbally. This is important, because sometimes people think a living will is like a will. If you make a will, then by and large you have to make another will in order to supersede the first. You know, you have to have a legal document which supersedes the previous legal document. If you say, oh, I do regret having said that in my will, but it's still in the will, then the will still binds. An advanced decision, if you say later, no, I've changed my mind, that's it. Now, it's sensible to write it down if you've written it down previously, because people might argue or not know, but legally, any verbal change of mind, or even a non-verbal change of mind, particularly if it's an area which concerns life-sustaining treatment, is enough so that the medical practitioner can then act in best interest. Is no longer bound by it. Because it's only you can withdraw an advanced decision at any time, so that's a safeguard. But even though it's a safeguard, in a way, I think with some of these things they've made of quite a strong power, and then they've tried to have some safeguards. So you know they've given a kid a gun, but then taken the bullets away. I mean they've given some quite strong powers, but then they've tried to have safeguards to it. But I'm not sure for my own mind, I think that the Act would have been a better Act if the powers in the first place were slightly less strong. And indeed, my understanding, which I don't have a great knowledge of it, but of the Scottish legislation, this only applies in England and Wales. If you're on holiday in Scotland and get knocked over or something, bear in mind. Or if you have friends who are in Scotland, the Scots have their own legislation, and by and large their legislation follows a similar pattern, but the original powers are not quite as strong in the first place, and the safeguards, the balance between the two is slightly different. But both north and south of the border, they do want to allow people to make decisions, but also wants there to be safeguards or exceptions, so that if it turns out to be something that's going to be disastrous, you can find a way around it. And again, by and large, this is something which I think one can accept from a Catholic perspective. But there are left two sensitive issues, and this is what sort of came up as a lot of it as we were nearing the end of our draft, really, but it came back from some of the comments. One is refusing and also respecting the refusal of assisted nutrition and hydration. I'll come onto it in a second, but this is a particular issue because of how you understand nutrition and hydration, and this is something which has been quite divisive, and also I'd say not only within the Catholic community but also among doctors. There's a range of views about assisted nutrition and hydration, and it causes extra problems or anxieties different from other sorts of treatment. And secondly, respecting, not here refusing yourself because you shouldn't refuse yourself, but respecting somebody else's advanced decision where that's clearly suicidal. Clearly suicidal and clearly valid and clearly applicable. I mean, you may be able to get around it if it's, you know, you say maybe it's not valid or applicable, but if it were, how do you deal with suicidal advanced decisions? And that was something Archbishop Peter mentioned, which came up near the end with respect to the parliamentary process as well, this exception. So those two, I think, are particularly sensitive issues. Artificial nutrition and hydration is commonly taken as medical treatment. It probably wouldn't be too strong to say in law is taken as medical treatment, though, as I say, I think it would be slightly more accurate to say in law, for certain purposes, it counts as medical treatment, one of which is the ability to refuse it. But as I say, there does seem to be, and this is from discussions in the work, and I was quite surprised, the discussions in the working group of the GMC, there is an awareness that in the country, both among patients and among doctors, nutrition and hydration often has a human meaning that varies from patient to patient and has a different sort of weight to it than other forms of treatment. And that may yet express itself in various ways. But at least for some purposes, it counts the same as medical treatment, and it counts in that ANH's artificial nutrition and hydration can be refused. Now, this is particularly a problem if the person is not otherwise dying, and the obvious case of that is people who are in a persistent vegetative state. People like Tony Bland was the famous case in 1993, where a person could live for months or years in that state. So they're not, it's not as though they're imminently dying. It's not as though they're days or weeks away from death. They could potentially live for a long time, and the withdrawing of treatment seems to be what causes their death, and in at least some cases seems to be what is intended to cause their death. So that's, I think, a particular problem. And I think that's the context where Pope John Paul II, and I think and other authorities, Catholic authorities, the Congregation for the Faith, have said that ANH's basic care, which should rarely, if ever, there is a little if ever, rarely, if ever, be withdrawn. But the context in which they're thinking of that is not end of life. The context in which they're thinking of that is people who is profoundly disabled people who could live a long time if they're given artificial nutrition and hydration, and they should ordinarily be given it. At least that's a Catholic teaching, which is in some ways in tension with current medical practice. Nevertheless, even with respect to this official teaching, end-of-life circumstances make the refusal of food and fluids possible as an option. And here I come onto another issue, and that's the difference between doctors. Doctors, you ask various doctors, and they differ on this, about whether it is ever sensible to withdraw, whether hydration in particular is ever sensible to withdraw, or it's commonly sensible to withdraw. And many people, particularly in palliative care, think that it should be quite commonly or even routinely withdrawn in the last few days. And other people, even in a palliative care context, but certainly outside that, think nobody should ever be dehydrated. And these are views that you find, I mean, say, not just among Catholics, but among clinicians generally. But there are at least some clinicians who say that towards the end of life, it doesn't do people any harm to be a little bit dehydrated. There isn't evidence, particularly if they have good mouth care, there isn't evidence that people actually suffer from withdrawal of hydration in the last few days, and perhaps Kathy will comment on this later. And so it may be a legitimate thing not to have, and therefore a legitimate thing to refuse. So even with withdrawing food and fluids, which generally we would think, oh, that will kill you, well, not necessarily if you're dying anyway, and not at this point. So even with withdrawing food and fluid, I think there's a little room for manoeuvre. What then to do in cases where there's an advanced decision which you think is not going to be a good decision for the patient, which is going to be harmful for the patient, or where you have an attorney who's making a decision which you think is bad for a patient? With an attorney, the first thing is to be ready to discuss with the attorney. The attorney is supposed to be making decisions in the best interest of the patient. That's what the attorney is for, to represent the best interest of the patient. And so if, as a member of the team or whatever, if you have some disagreement about whether you think a decision is in their best interest, the first thing is to ask why they think it's in their best interest and to talk about best interests. If necessary, if you think, or if a healthcare professional thinks that the attorney is acting against the best interests of the patient, then there are various things that they can do to try to resist this. And I think we have yet to see in case law how this will play out. And my guess is, if it can be demonstrated that the attorney isn't representing what the person would have wished, but is representing, as it were, the hang-ups of the attorney, rather than what the patient themselves would have said, and if you can give evidence of that, that the attorney's word won't hold. But if the attorney seems to be representing, or there's no evidence to the contrary, what the patient would have wished, the attorney's view will hold, even if the doctor thinks differently. That's my suspicion, but those are the sorts of things which will be tested in law, I'm sure. With advanced decisions, again, is it really applicable? Is it really, and is it valid in the first place? And how long ago was it made? Has it been updated? Those sorts of things, they are relevant. But ultimately, you ask if they're valid. If they are valid and applicable, then in law, they have to be respected. The law is quite clear that somebody can refuse treatment, even if unwisely, and that an advanced decision counts as a, if it's valid and applicable, counts as a refusal of treatment. And if they have done so, then you are not able to treat them. And how we have phrased it in the booklet is, at this point, that aspect of care has been withdrawn from the professional responsibility. So that even if you're not happy with that decision, you're no longer responsible for that decision. The law has effectively taken that responsibility out of your hands. Now, if you strongly disagree with the resultant care plan, then you may wish to show this in various ways, and maybe as a matter of conscience, you may have to withdraw from the care of the patient altogether. But we did not say that that was always the case. Even in cases where something was happening which you thought was harmful for the patient, there may still be a reason that you should continue other parts of that patient's care for the sake of solidarity with the patient, say. Though obviously there's a danger there with scandal, what other people thinking you're approving, but if you're not able to do one thing that you'd like to do, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to withdraw from the patient. But it might in an individual case, and that might be a case of conscience. And there are... the Act does give some scope for conscientious objection, for withdrawing from the patient under those circumstances, provided that the care of the patient doesn't otherwise suffer. So again, if you can find someone else who could do the job, and this also might vary depending on the circumstances in which you care for them. In some circumstances, it will be quite easy to hand over to somebody else or withdraw yourself from it. In other cases, much more difficult. And say you're running a home or something, then, you know, do you say they can't be in this home anymore or this hospice? I mean, clearly, in some cases, you're continuing care for them, even though you're ambivalent about the nature of that care, which has been restricted. That can be itself a positive witness. So I say there's a remaining question of what you do if you don't agree. But I think the law is clear and in that way admirable in terms of what limits it places. And then the question is, well, given that there are limits about what we can do, what do we do instead?